Hey listeners, welcome to the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. I'm Will and I'm joined today by absolutely nobody. Literally all the others are on holiday, but I'm very excited to share with you a little bit of bonus content. So as some of you who follow us through other mediums will know, Mohammed recently interviewed Marvin Sordell, the former Watford and England under-21s forward. We've packaged together in audio form their discussion on a host of topics, including a Brendan Rodgers anecdote, because who doesn't love those, and what Sean Dyche is really like. These guys also go into the issues of mental health and racism in football, serious subjects, of course, and there can be ones that are hard to listen to, but for whatever it's worth, I urge you not to miss out on Marvin's insights. There are a few ex-pros about right now who speak so insightfully about these things. For those interested in seeing the interview with their own eyes, head over to the Squawker Football YouTube channel, where it's already been uploaded. And also rest assured, we will be back on Thursday when your regularly scheduled podcast will return ahead of a Premier League game week involving West Ham v Spurs, Manchester City vs Chelsea, and on Sunday afternoon, it's only the Mohammed Butt Derby as he'll have to pick between Sheffield United and Manchester United. If you like us, please rate and review on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. We do really value your feedback when reading those. For now, though, all that remains is for me to say, enjoy this bonus episode when Mo met Marvin.
Hi, everyone. This is Mohammed Butt. Welcome to Squawker. And here we are with the marvellous Marvin Sordell, former Watford player, Burton player, England under-21 international, and member of Team GB. How you doing, Marvin?
Good to have you. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that means there's only one place to start, really. What was up with those Team GB kits? They were awful.
They're really, really tight.
Really?
Yeah, they were designed by Stella McCartney.
I mean, I don't understand. What did the squad think of them? They can't have been too fun, surely.
To be honest, no one really ever mentioned. This is the first time I've ever been presented that question.
Really?
Actually, they were very, very tight.
Yeah.
And they made you sweat a lot.
Well,
I've never actually thought about it, to be honest, but yeah,
it's a fair question. To me, that's honestly, apart from the fact that Beckham wasn't in the squad, that's always the one thing I think of when I think of Team GB. I'm like, oh my God, those shirts. But speaking of shirts, let's go on to your campaign that you've recently run, Let's Shirt Talk, hashtag Let's Shirt Talk, about raising awareness of mental health in football, encouraging people who are struggling with mental health in football as sportsmen to speak up and talk, you know. And you did this by auctioning off some rather famous shirts, some pretty impressive ones, including a Team GB shirt, I do believe, right? Ryan Giggs. So how'd that go? How much did you raise? And
I can't remember the figure off the top of my head now. It was a couple of thousand. It was a raffle, so the tickets were £5 each.
Yeah.
I wanted to do it that way. Yeah. Because I wanted it to be as accessible as possible, and as opposed to an auction where you might get 15 wealthy people who might bid for the shirts.
Yeah, keep it
easy. This way you get a lot of people, and then that way as well you get to spread the message of mental health and awareness much further rather than just keeping it in a very close bubble.
Yeah, the last thing you want is for it to become like a rich person's plaything, really, because I mean, like football, you want it to be available for everyone.
And they were my shirts as well, so you know, I wanted them to go to, I didn't want them just to go to, you know,
the collectors or whatever, right?
I wanted them to go to good homes.
Yeah. Were you happy with which shirt was the most popular? I mean, obviously they were raffle. Which shirt was most popular? Which shirt sold the most?
They were all in together.
Oh, okay,
raffle,
right.
So it was just I'd probably say the most popular. I don't know, but I would have guessed it would have been Ryan Giggs.
Really? What was your favorite of those shirts?
Yeah, Ryan Giggs is one.
Giggs as well.
It was signed.
Yeah, I suppose.
You know, it's a Team GB shirt as well.
Which of those players, which of any players, I suppose, was the best player you ever played against? Because, I mean, it sounds like, from what you said about Thiago Silva in the video, it sounds like he was he was a bit unstoppable.
You look at the level he's played at in his career, and you know, it's no surprise that he's the best player I've played against.
Yeah, I remember you described that you just bounced off him, and that's a pretty evocative image, you know.
Yeah, I remember going on the pitch and I literally felt like a kid amongst giants. And getting his shirt at the end of the game, we've had to do running after the game because, you know, the subs who haven't played that much. And there wasn't any warm-up kit because we I think the women's team were playing after us, so we've had to get changed quite quickly to.
Right.
They packed up all the kit, and so I've got Thiago Silva shirt, because I've swapped shirts with him, and I haven't got a jumper or anything, so I put it on, and it's drowned me. And I'm like, Jimmy. And I, you know, you look at pictures of him wearing it, and it's tight as anything.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, he's a big guy.
He's a big guy. That's funny, because you don't look at him and think, yeah, that's a big guy.
But no, exactly.
He's massive. That's interesting. But keeping it to players you play, well, players you play with, for example, obviously, who is better when you play with them? Just bringing it to your under 21 days. Ox Oxlade-Chamberlain or Raheem Sterling, which one of those two was better when you play with them, you know, at that level?
At that time?
Yeah.
I would have probably said Alex Chamberlain.
Yeah?
I think he was just ahead of Raheem was in terms of just his understanding of the game and his tactical knowledge. Right. And technically, he's superb. I mean, yeah. Raheem was just... He can do outrageous things.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not surprised to see him go on to the level he's at now.
I mean, yeah,
and he will go further. I mean,
he's now basically England's best player. And yeah. I mean, like you said, I mean, if he sharpens up his finishing, he could go even become top.
He's
top,
not doing
top,
too
top.
Bad.
Well, I know, but I mean, you know, that's the crazy thing about it is he's doing brilliant. There's still room for improvement.
And he's still very young as well.
What's it feel like to play with players like that? Like, you know, to watch them, like, do you take a sort of sense of pride? Like, I play with those great players, you know what I mean? And you know.
Not anything for me personally. Yeah. I'm just really happy for them. They're like, yeah. You know, a lot of the players I play, they see how hard they work and see how talented they are as well. And you know, I just think I'm just really pleased that, you know, they've become even more successful. You see Alex Chamberlain came off the back of a long-term injury.
I mean, yeah, that's his comeback.
Champions League, and yeah. You see Raheem Sterling after a couple of years he's had, not football-wise.
No, not football-wise, no. He's had
a lot of things, yeah. You know, that make up the industry that I've spoken about and
yeah.
have made it difficult for him. But he's really, you know, he's I think he's had very strong backing from both Gareth Southgate and Pep Guardiola.
Yeah,
which, you know, they're that's amazing, you know, for a player to have so much support from the people who make the biggest decisions in their career is so important and you know, he's clearly paying them back as well.
Yeah. So I mean, you mentioned managers there. Let's move on to managers. You know, who is the best manager you ever played under in your career? Like, would you say? Well, if not the best, then the one who had the most impact.
I'll give two answers.
Okay.
One manager I actually didn't play under, but was at Watford and gave me my pro contract, actually, was Brendan Rodgers.
Okay.
And when he came into Watford at the time were not the club they are today.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've heard about this manager who's coming from Chelsea reserves and nobody knew really that much about him. And his methods and training and his coaching, his attention to detail is just incredible, and the way he manages the players, the manages people, you know,
it's
funny that in football managers are called managers because not all managers manage people and are good at managing people. You know, they're either coaches or they pick teams or whatever.
Yeah.
But he was very good at managing the people and the players and keeping everyone happy as well, which is a very difficult thing when you can only select 11 players. And for me as a young player to learn off the coach, it just had so much intelligence and knowledge and about the game was just great. Except when he gave me my pro contract, I remember going into his office and pretty much for about 10 minutes, he sat there telling me the things I wasn't good at. And then at the end, he said, by the way, you're going to get your pro contract. Well, I genuinely thought, he's just been grilling me for 10 minutes. I'm probably not going to get a contract.
Well, I mean, that's one hell of a way to say, okay, now there's your bar. Get to us. Yeah.
Beyond that, the coach and manager that's had the biggest impact on my career by far is Sean Dyche. You know, he's my youth team manager, my reserve manager, my first team manager at Watford.
Yeah.
And then as well at Burnley as well.
So I was going to ask about Sean Dyche. His image is obviously very much, it's larger than life. character? Like, what's he actually like? Like, you know, I mean, you've been under him for so many different teams and everything. What's he actually like as a person, as a coach, one on one?
In what perspective?
Well, I mean, like, you know, not so much tactically, but what's he, is he, you know, how good is he? Like, is he more of a? You mentioned earlier coaches and managers. You know, different scene. Is he more of a manager or is he more of a coach?
Both. I'd say both. Yeah. He's very much a leader. Yeah. I think it probably stems from his playing days, but you know, you see the way his teams are set up, it's because of his coaching ability, but the way, the effort that they put in is because of how he leads his teams. And so, you know, for me, it's no surprise how well he's done as a manager, because he's been like that since, you know, he came in when I was, 16.
Wow. Yeah. So you've watched, as much as you've watched yourself and other players have their career, you've watched his managerial rise, I suppose.
Yeah, which has been amazing, really.
Do you think he could go higher than Burnley? Do you think he could manage a club, a bigger club than, I mean, with all respects to Burnley, obviously. I mean,
of course,
he's made them into a Premier League club. But do you think he could manage, you know, a European level club, maybe even a top four club?
Yeah, I mean, he has to as well remember how young he is for a manager. He's not been a manager for that long. And he's come a long way and been very, very successful, especially at Burnley.
Yeah.
And I think he can go on to manage one of the top clubs in the country, potentially even national team. You know, people will probably look at that and or hear that and laugh and think, you know, he's a long ball manager or something like that. What he does is he gets the best out of his players. Like, you know, whatever.
Burnley don't usually have that many dribblers. But even then, look, you look at Dwight McNeil, who he's brought through, who's very much a dribbling player. So obviously there's room to expand on his repertoire, which, I mean, right now has been, like you said, it's been long ball, but that's the players he's had. So that's interesting. So Sean Dyche is much better than we previously. So that's good to know. That's, yeah, he's because he's a nice character. Everyone loves him, but it's like you always want to know that you're not just sort of throwing your faith behind an image of a person. It's good to know that he actually is.
I've worked with a lot of coaches and a lot of managers in the game, and he's, you know, right up there. You know, for his understanding, his wanting to develop his tactical knowledge, his leadership. You know, he's has a lot to offer as a manager, and obviously he's continuously developing, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right, so moving on to the crux of Let's Shirt Talk, right, which is mental health in football. Now, obviously, I mean, you retired this summer, you know, citing mental health. And how's that been for you? How's retired life treating you?
I absolutely love it.
Yeah?
I've often been asked if I regret making a decision or if I'm going to change my mind. And I genuinely couldn't think of anything worse than to go back and, you know, continue being a professional football player.
Really? This is obviously a silly question in a way, but what's the difference been for you for coming from the world of being a professional footballer suddenly to now being a normal person?
I mean, I was a normal person.
Well, what I mean? You know, not basically not under the spotlight of being a professional footballer, that's the funny thing, is all footballers, even ones like in the EFL, which isn't top tier, are subject to this incredible scrutiny and gaze of
professionalism. I think social media's changed everything in football over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, I'd say, in particular.
Yeah.
And I mean, there is a lot of pressure. You know, you think people go out there, and you know, most players that are living their dream. You know, they go out there and they love what they do, and to them they want to enjoy it as well. But there's a lot of pressure of coming from people who, you know, look at the game as more than just, you know, what it actually is, which is a game.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it's life and death and
well, there's the famous Bill Shankly quote, isn't it? Football isn't life and death. It's more important than even that, which you know, I suppose is. Did you ever feel like it was a really different sport, a different world, or did you feel like it was sort of, they've sort of added so much pressure and sort of almost taken the fun out of a child's game?
Yeah, I mean, that happens to, you know, it happened to me, it happens to a lot of players. I've spoken to so many players, not just in recent months or years, like throughout my career. I've spoken to different players at different ages and different levels who've all said, you know, you get to a certain age and it becomes a job, which is sad, really, because most, like I said, most players go into the game and play football because it's their escape, it's what they love, it's what they're passionate about. And to have that passion kind of just hammered away and chipped away over years is quite sad, but you know, it is the nature of the game, and people, players understand that that's how it is.
Yeah, it's, well, it's big business, isn't it? I suppose football now, so it's but you know, I think campaigns like Let's Shirt Talk obviously are very important, and I think the tide, to a degree, the tide is changing almost. Like there was two seasons ago, Andre Gomez, Barcelona player, when he, well, he was at Barcelona, now he's at Everton, he was obviously, he came out and he had an article, an interview published where he basically admitted that he had been struggling greatly with mental health issues because of the pressures of playing for Barcelona. He couldn't handle the pressure, and he was obviously much derided by Barcelona fans. Didn't play well for them. But then the next game after the first game after the interview, he came off the bench and he was applauded by the whole stadium. And I mean, I think obviously that's one isolated incident and everything, but I do think it sort of signals a willingness to address the idea of mental health as not just something that, oh yeah, mental health, it's just you know, but as something that is genuinely real in football, in sport. You know, and do you think we are progressing in the right direction? And do you think there will come a time when people will realize, or maybe think of, oh, that player's not playing well. Maybe he's struggling mentally. Maybe he's had, maybe he's got a problem, rather than just, oh, he's rubbish. You know,
it's hard to say because of the way social media and kind of the analysis of the game of football has come on so much. You know, it's every tiny detail. They talk about VAR and players offside by a millimeter.
Yeah.
And every single little detail gets looked into for, you know, hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
But I think where football has come in the space of mental health and I guess people more being aware of it and more connecting to players on a human level, I think is because, you know, for quite some time players have been put on some pedestal for some reason that they're, you know, untouchable and they're objects, they're not human beings. And I think people warm to the fact that they, it's as sad as it is for players to struggle for mental health, it gives other people in every other walk of life, it gives them something to relate to these people and see them as equal human beings, which they are,
because, as normal people, as you said earlier.
People,
I mean, I suppose that's. I mean, it's, you know, it's never good anyone struggling with mental health. But I suppose the one thing is footballers being role models just by existing, almost by admitting that they suffer with, oh yeah, I have mental health problems too. It becomes for kids especially. You know, kids growing up struggling with mental health issues, and they think, oh okay, so this is normal. Mm. You know, it's okay if you're sad. That's, you know, that's something that happens to everyone. Literally. But you mentioned social media there again, and it made me think about, you know, it can be a force for good, but obviously recently what we've seen it mostly used for is a tool for people to vent racial abuse at black players. I mean, black players of colour, but especially black players in particular in England. Actually, not just even in England, actually, all around the place. What do you, what have you made of that? Like, do you think, is there extra mental health, like, extra pressure on your mental health, being a black player having to suffer through racial abuse?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Do you develop when you're? I mean, obviously, this is not, racism is not a football problem. It's a societal problem. So it's difficult. It's harder. But how do you develop a sort of thicker skin to sort of not just get on with it, obviously, but like to be able to withstand the abuse almost?
I would say it's beyond football. It's you know, it starts before football.
Yeah,
I think.
Obviously. Yeah.
You know, you're growing up in this world, really.
Yeah.
You know, this world tends to be racist at times.
Yes. Yes. Obviously.
And you know, not just, you know, in your face and just institutional racism that is ingrained in society and these are things that most people's parents, you know, my mum, just prepared me for when I was younger.
I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? It's that we often think of, and I think the way that racism is treated in football, I've noticed of late, it's very much like, oh, these are bad actors, we'll ban these guys because these fans are saying racial. And that's good, you should ban people that say racial
things.
But at the same time, it does seem to sort of obfuscate the actual problem, which is that, as you say, institutional racism, societal racism, the subtle attitudes and stigmas that we allow to continue that stereotype black players, for instance. I mean, you mentioned Raheem Sterling going back to the start, and the way that he was spoken about consistently in the press was every single thing was it, if it was not specifically, objectively, like saying this, you know, some racist thing, it was very much dog whistle, a lot of coded language that we know, we know what you're saying. Do you know what I mean? And it's, I mean, is there a way for football to combat it effectively? I mean, beyond just saying, hey, people, can you not do that? You know, I mean, the bans are one thing, but like Raheem Sterling, obviously, some people have called for points deductions and stadium bans. I mean, do you think those penalties are too harsh, or do you think that it has to be that harsh for people to actually get the message?
It needs to be that harsh. That's you know, if what's already happening isn't working, then it's not harsh enough, clearly, because people are still doing it. Now, of course, many will say it's not a problem in, it's not a football problem, it's a societal problem, which is true.
Yeah.
But football has a responsibility because football is a part of society.
Yeah.
You can't just say, well, it's above us.
Yeah.
You know, because then nobody's going to do anything, nobody's going to get everything done because it's always above somebody.
Yeah.
If you as a part of something bigger collectively can play your part in changing something, then should. Yeah. So football should do what it can to change society and be a part of the change in society.
Yeah.
It's not going to change society completely, but it can do its part.
Well, I mean, the poet Musa Okwonga has he once said to me that sport can often, it's sport can't change society, but it can show society the way, almost like Muhammad Ali in the 60s. What he didn't change anything,
because
he showed people that the war in Vietnam is wrong. I'm standing up for my rights, my religious beliefs. And I mean, history proved him correct, obviously, with the Vietnam War and drafting and everything. But so I think, and I mean, you have to have immense respect for black players in particular who stand up against racism, because not only have they, I mean, they've already been racially abused, and now they're basically inviting more of it by saying this is wrong. Yeah. I think you're right that nothing could be too harsh. Like, no, like points deductions seems to be like, oh, you can't punish the team for the play. But then if you don't, I think there's no incentive for the fans to change their behavior. If a team misses out on a league title because they got deducted points for their fans being racist, I mean, that's millions of dollars, tens of millions of pounds, then the owners are going to start taking notice. And then it's not just going to be about banning orders, it's going to be about working in the community to try and eradicate, which is what I think we really need.
Exactly.
To try and eradicate these problems. And I think, loss of points, stadium bans would be a big deterrent. I mean, it would take time, but I think it would...
It's going to take time.
Yeah.
I mean, this is hundreds of years in the making.
Literally.
It's going to take time to reverse that, to change that.
Yeah.
But you have to start somewhere. You can't expect things to change without actually making change.
That's a good way of putting it. So just to put a tag on this, obviously you directly, I mean, obviously, I'm assuming you've suffered it. There's been multiple instances of racism that you suffered throughout your career, but most notably, I think at Bolton, you really, like Dougie Freeman came out and said you were really struggling with homesickness because of the abuse you faced. Did they really take your phone from you?
No.
So that was just...
I don't know where that came from, to be honest, but no.
I think he's a grown man. That's a bit weird. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Okay. Well, that makes a lot more sense. But I mean, Was it a struggle playing in Bolton away from where you grew up, obviously, in London?
Yeah, I mean, what I found most difficult was not playing. That was by far the biggest struggle, and you know, there were a lot of things that happened around. I mean, I struggled with the move because I think it everything came very quickly. And I didn't have the time to settle. I had a lot of pressure placed upon me, and which is something that I completely wasn't used to, you know, coming from Watford at the time and to going to a Premier League club, a very big club.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of expectation put on me very quickly, and I was only 20 when I moved. And, you know, moving literally overnight to somewhere you know, never been.
Yeah, Bolton's a different world. If you come from anywhere, Watford or South Watford, Bolton's a different world. What do you? I mean, was there any inkling then I mean, because obviously Bolton have hit very big financial trouble of late. Was there any inkling then that they that there was any idea that the club was spending beyond their means? Yeah. Yeah?
I mean, we had a thing. I remember turning up for one of my first games. I drove to the car park and they had three people, I think, to park the players' cars. So you turn up, you'd stop your car, leave the engine running, you'd get out, someone would park the car to about 20 feet away. And you didn't, I looked and I thought, what is the point of that? Like, I can literally park my car myself because I do it every single day.
Yeah, that's...
And, you know, there would probably be a lot of things. A lot of Bolton fans would probably say me, which is fair, you know, fair enough. But there was a lot of money was probably wasted on things like that.
Let's go back to that night in Serbia for England under-21s when you won 1-0, but obviously horrendous, infamous for the horrendous racial abuse you suffered. I mean... Maybe a dumb question. How obvious was it? Was it as obvious as the players made it sound? Like it was just like unending racial abuse from the stands.
I mean, it was when we went out to look at the pitch in our tracksuits before the game.
Yeah,
there were quite a lot of fans in the stadium at that time, and it was happening from then. You know, monkey chants from that's probably what an hour and a half before kickoff.
Yeah, that's
So, and so from there to the end, throughout the game.
So you can see why Danny Rose kind of lost it at the end, don't you? Yeah. I mean, it's understandable. What was it? I mean, obviously, you know, you played 60 minutes, I think, in that night. What was? Did it affect your game? Do you think? I mean, having to, or could you have shaken off, or did it really just like?
It didn't really affect me. I kind of, you know, when you're playing the game,
you're
very much like focusing. You're just on the game, what's happening, and you can't really hear and you know, see what's going on in the stands and things like that. And it's only there were only small moments when I, you know, really like kind of tuned out and heard it when I picked up a ball for a throw in, or
when you stop, right? When the ball goes dead,
which obviously you can imagine Danny Rose is taking a lot of throw ins.
Yeah, he must.
So every time he goes to pick up the ball, he's hearing it. And you know, like you said, it just chips away. And you just think, why, as a human being, am I being looked at as inferior?
Yeah. Did it sour you on wanting to represent your country at
no,
all? Or
no,
did you just
not,
think?
I mean, that didn't sour me at all.
Yeah.
To be honest, I think, you know, I see racism now differently to probably how I did when I was younger. Huh? I think it's just sad, really, that so many people are so closed-minded and they don't get to experience the world and how amazing the world is to its full capacity because they're so close-minded and ignorant in their ways to seeing how amazing so many different cultures are. And, you know, it's just sad, really.
Yeah. To close this off, obviously, Gareth Southgate has voiced his support for the idea that if the players receive racial abuse again in 2019, that the players should be free to walk off. The players should walk off the pitch. Do you support that? Do you support that idea?
I think that's probably the team should be doing.
Yeah.
I think, again, I go back to the point of financially it affecting, you know, the likes of UEFA, FIFA. You know, if...
I mean, TV broadcasters as well. They're walking off the pitch during a televised game. So
yeah, if imagine you have England, France, let's say Portugal, Brazil, all saying they're not going to play in the World Cup, as an example.
Yeah,
that's a big problem for FIFA.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
All of a sudden,
that would
completely change the game, because they say actually we have to address this because without those nations, the World Cup isn't the same.
There is no World Cup, is it? Without the players, there is no game. So we've looked back at your career and the things you've been through, things you've suffered, things you've done. What are you doing now? I mean, obviously, you know, you're retired since the summer. So what are you up to these days?
I own a production company, so video production, which we just we do a lot of different types of things, but the number one thing, you know, overall is that we just want to tell stories and engage in powerful ways.
That's how, I mean, you're, obviously your production company put on the Let Shirt Talk campaign. Yeah. So that was the first one. And that was an, I thought that was an effective campaign. So let's hope there's more to come from all of that. Marvin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.